This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Rilke's letters to a young poet were written to a young man, Franz Kapus, who'd sent him some poems. They're extraordinary letters, wise and inspiring, especially when you consider he wrote the first one when he was only 26. They contain excellent advice about writing poetry. They are also concerned with Rilke's preoccupation at the time, how to construct a life that would best enable his writing. Most of what he says is relevant to poets of both sexes who are juggling with the problems of art versus life. But it's aimed specifically at a young man, warning him against domestic entanglements. That's why I'm writing to you, an aspiring young woman poet with two small children. We don't know what Rilke might have written to a young woman. We do know what the poet laureate Robert Southey wrote in 1837 to a young Charlotte Bronte when she sent him her poems. "Madam, literature cannot be the business of a woman's life. The more she is engaged in her proper duties, the less leisure she will have for it, even as an accomplishment and a recreation. To those duties you have not yet been called. And when you are, you will be less eager for celebrity." In her reply, loaded with irony, she assures him, "I have endeavoured not only attentively to observe all the duties a woman ought to fulfil, but to feel deeply interested in them. I don't always succeed, for sometimes when I'm teaching or sewing, I would rather be reading or writing. But I try to deny myself. I trust I shall never more feel ambitious to see my name in print. If the wish should arise, I will look at Southey's letter and suppress it." Not surprisingly, when the Bronte sisters published their poems, they adopted male pseudonyms. Women novelists sometimes did that too. But novelists can hide inside their fictions, in the many voices. The I voice of the lyric poet, the opposite of the girls who was brought up to be seen and not heard, allows no disguise. A woman poet in the 19th century, writing honestly about her feelings and experiences, exposed herself to double censure. From men whose ideal woman was modestly spoken, and from other women brought up under the rules of patriarchy. Even in 1904, when Rilke began his letters to Kapus, the literary world was cautious about admitting women poets. "It is only one day," he wrote, "that there will be girls and women whose name will no longer just signify the opposite of the male, but something in their own right." Had he never heard of Elizabeth Barrett Browning or Christina Rossetti, or indeed the German poet Annette von Droste-Hülshoff, all who fulfilled his criteria? Even in the mid-1970s, when I began to write, there were still relatively few women poets being published. In the first series of Penguin Modern Poets, appearing between 1962 and 1975, only 4 out of 81 poets were women. The 40 years since has seen a revolution in women's poetry. It was fueled by a series of feminist anthologies containing work rediscovered from a buried tradition of women poets. It's gathered momentum until women are taking many of the main poetry prizes. We even have a female poet laureate. So there's no longer a problem for women poets, you're thinking. I'm tempted to write no. But the consensus among my women poet friends is that poetry editors, most of whom are men, are still prejudiced against poetry written from a women's point of view. I'd argue that our work is strong and original because we have a different point of view. Women poets aren't pale imitations of male poets. We have a different history of being men's other, either monsters and seductresses or angels and Madonnas, of belonging to the nursery, not the university, of being the servants, not the masters, of being silenced and of silencing ourselves. It's that history that gives us our energy, that fires our determination to write as we want. A leading male poet is reputed to have said recently that he felt sorry for women poets because the muse is female and he doesn't know what women poets do for a muse. Surely he knows Joe Shapcott's playfully subversive version of a muse, who, as she puts it, has to be kissed in all the folding places of your body before you fall quiet, because only then can I get the damned words to come into my mouth. The stale male convention of a desirable woman as muse goes with Rilke's theory that writing poetry is like sex. Maybe for women it's closer to childbirth. Our poems are like babies, as the anonymous 17th century woman thought, who gave her divine poems and meditations the title Eliza's Babes. Sylvia Plath, in her poem Stillborn, compares poems that don't come to life to dead babies. Rilke's answer to the young poet who wonders if his poems live is to ask himself in night's quietest hour, must I write? If the answer is I must, he must construct his life according to this necessity. For Rilke, there was no question of what this involved. What is needed for a poet is this, and this alone, solitude, great inner loneliness. After only a couple of years of trying to make a conventional living for his wife and child, he felt as if someone had closed the window toward the garden in which my songs live. But if Rilke couldn't write without solitude, how have women poets, who in the past have been the childbearers and main child carers, managed to write at all? The answer is that many of them, Emily Bronte, Emily Dickinson, Charlotte Mew, Stevie Smith, Marion Moore, Elizabeth Bishop, to name a few, have remained spinsters or childless. For women poets today, who are like you, are mothers of young children, it's certainly difficult, but not impossible. Solitude can be found, if only in snatches, as Sylvia Plath discovered, waking to write in the early mornings, before the baby's cry, before the glassy music of the milkman. And our experience as women can enrich our poetry, becoming the subject. Marriage, domesticity, pregnancy, childbirth, child care, and female sexuality have provided wonderful material for us, shaking up the received male poet's view of the world. For me, answering Rilke's question, must I write, is to revisit my first impulse, age 9, when I read Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, to become a poet. Of course, I wouldn't literally die, but a part of me would die, as it did in the years when I didn't write, when I put what Southey, in his letter to Charlotte Bronte, called a woman's proper duties, in front of my ambition to be a poet. If I'm honest, my late start had as much to do with fear of not being able to write as with domestic responsibilities. I was daunted by reading Wordsworth and Keats and all the other great poets of the male canon. Two things helped my poetry take off. I began to read more contemporary poetry, and I joined a poetry workshop where I got encouragement and constructive criticism. Another huge impetus for me was discovering the work of the American poets Adrienne Rich and Sharon Olds. It took off the pressure to feel that if only I could write using an impersonal voice, that is one that might be mistaken for a man's, my work could be taken more seriously. I discovered what I should have discovered 20 years earlier reading Sylvia Plath, the power of writing as a woman, even of domestic tasks, as she does in a poem like Cut. What a thrill, my thumb instead of an onion. In my poem, Ironing, the task becomes a metaphor for my recovery from the despair and anger of being trapped by domesticity. It begins with the iron flying over sheets and towels, like a sledge chased by wolves over snow, the flecks twisting and crinking, exposing wires like nerves. It ends with the pleasure of breathing the sweet heated smell, hot metal draws from newly washed cloth, until my blouse dries to a shining, creaseless blue, an airy shape with room to push my arms, breasts, lungs, heart into. Another breakthrough was to realise that I could write about my feelings and experiences, as Stevie Smith often did, from behind the mask of a character in a story. I found in the fairy tale character of the Handless Maiden, a parallel for my years of paralysis and rebirth as a writer. The story is of a girl who has her hands cut off to escape the devil, and who is given silver hands by her husband. In the Grimm's version, her hands grow back because she is good for 7 years. In the Russian version, they grow back when she drops her baby into a spring and plunges her handless arms into the water to rescue him. The psychoanalyst Marie von Franz, in her book The Feminine in Fairy Tales, interprets the baby as her lost creativity. It's only heroines who lose their hands, she argues. Only women who in effect cut off their hands and live vicariously through creative men. The story haunted me for years, but it was only when I went on my own and experienced the loneliness and difficulty that Rilke describes as the ideal conditions for a poet that I found a way of writing the poem. Walking by a swollen river, I wondered what I'd do if I dropped my baby into it and had just rescued her. Gradually, over the next few days, I wrote drafts of a poem, writing by hand to be more in touch with my body. Initially, I wrote in the third person. Then I changed to the first person voice of the Handless Maiden in the moment after she has rescued her baby. When all the water had run from her mouth, and I'd rubbed her arms and legs and chest and belly and back with clumps of dried moss, and I'd put her to sleep in a nest of grass and spread her dripping clothes on a bush and held her again, her heat passing into my breast and shoulder, the breath I couldn't believe in, like a tickling feather on my neck, I let myself cry. I cried for my hands my father cut off, for the lumpy, itching scars of my stumps, for the silver hands my husband gave me that spun and wove but had no feeling, and for my handless arms that let my baby drop, unwinding from the tight swaddling cloth as I drank from the brimming river. And I cried for my hands that sprouted in the red-orange mud, the hands that write this, grasping her curled fists. Writing that poem through a series of drafts felt like a triumph. I'd found a way of telling the Handless Maiden story that was also my story, though in my case, the baby that might have drowned in the river was my poems. You, I'm sure, are a much more confident writer. But most poets, not only young ones, encounter difficulties. My remedy for myself is threefold. I read the poets I admire, men as well as women. I read Rilke's letters, especially his advice to embrace difficulty rather than avoiding it. Lastly, I simply pick up a pen and write.